The headlines are on to Parliament reviews the remaining ministers from President Raisi's proposed lineup before a vote of confidence for the cabinet. Venezuela accuses the U.S. of crimes against humanity in a report submitted to the International Criminal Court about the impacts of Washington's sanctions on the country. And the World Health Organization says COVID surges are pushing health systems to the red line in the Western Pacific region. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour. Iran's parliament is debating the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi for fifth and most probably last day. Lawmakers have so far reviewed the qualifications of 15 out of 19 picks on Raisi's list for ministerial posts. The proposed ministers take the podium to present their plans and defend themselves. Then, their supporters and opponents come up on the stage to speak for or against them. A vote of confidence will be held for the whole list this afternoon if the review is completed today. Raisi is expected to put up a final defense for his choices at Parliament before the vote. All of the nominees are predicted to win the confidence vote. However, if any of them fails, the president will have up to 3 months to name a replacement. A Palestinian man has died of wounds he sustained after being shot by Israeli forces in the besieged Gaza Strip. 32-year-old Osama Khalid was shot and wounded during an anti-Israel protest on Saturday. At least 40 more Palestinians were wounded by Israeli forces during the protest in east of Gaza City. They were marking the 52nd anniversary of Israel's burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque. Osama Khalid's death comes a day after another Palestinian was shot dead by Israeli troops. Imad Hashash, a teenager, was killed when Israeli forces attacked a refugee camp near Nablus. North of the occupied West Bank, tensions have remained high in the West Bank and Gaza in recent months, as Israel has escalated its crackdown against Palestinians. Our Gaza correspondent Asher Shannon says the silence of the international community on Israeli crimes is adding insult to injury of the Palestinian people.
Well, the apathy of the international community has been witnessed for decades. But this apathy and the silence of the international community increased rapidly following the normalization of ties between some Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region and the Israeli regime. Palestinians feel that they've been stabbed in the back by those Arabs, by the Arabs in the Persian Gulf region, and they believe that their normalization of ties and the opening of consulates and embassies, similar to that of the United Arab Emirates in Tel Aviv, only gave Israel the green light to further kill and maim Palestinians.
Israeli forces have demolished several more buildings belonging to Palestinian families in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian sources say the regime bulldozers backed by troops destroyed a house in the Silwan neighborhood in East Al-Quds. The demolition of the 90-square-meter house was carried out under the pretext of lacking construction license. Elsewhere in Al-Walaja village near the city of Bethlehem, Israeli bulldozers tore down another house. A car workshop was also flattened near the city of Al-Khalil. Under a similar pretext, Israel demolishes houses on a regular basis in the occupied territory, citing different pretexts. Palestinians and rights groups say the Israeli demolition drive is aimed at grabbing more land for settlement expansions. Venezuela says it has handed over a report to the International Criminal Court on the damage caused by U.S. sanctions against the country. Caracas has accused Washington of crimes against humanity.
Yesterday, Venezuela submitted a report containing evidence of the damage caused by unilateral coercive measures against the Venezuelan people to the Office of the Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court.
Rodriguez said there are reasonable grounds that the U.S. authorities have committed inhumane acts against the Venezuelan civilian population. She said crimes of murder, persecution, and extermination are some of those acts. The U.S. has stepped up its punitive measures against Venezuela in the past several years. It did so following Venezuela's 2018 presidential elections that the opposition claimed had been rigged. The U.S. also threw its backing behind opposition leader Juan Guaido, who declared himself president in January 2019. Venezuela has repeatedly urged the U.S. to stop interfering in its internal affairs. China and the United States have accused each other of bullying and coercion as the two remain at loggerheads over key issues, including security in the South China Sea. Vice President Kamala Harris has called for challenging China's excessive maritime claims. She made the comments during talks with Vietnamese officials in Hanoi. Harris is there as part of her Asian tour. In Singapore, she said Beijing's actions in the South China Sea amount to coercion and intimidation. Chinese state media said Harris's comments aimed to drive a wedge between Beijing and other countries in the region. The foreign ministry also reacted, accused the U.S. of hegemonic behavior. Beijing said Washington hides behind rhetoric of a rules-based global order to defend its practice. Political commentator George Samueli believes the United States is not by any means able to form a coalition in East Asia to stand against China.
The United States is having problems putting together an anti-China coalition in Southeast Asia along the lines of the famous Cold War anti-Russia coalition in Europe that actually survived the Cold War, the NATO, which is still in existence. The many countries in Southeast Asia and in Asia as a whole have very extensive commercial ties with China and don't wish to mess those up. So while countries such as Vietnam, Singapore, or the Philippines may have concerns about China, other countries are very dependent on commercial relations with China and will not want to join any kind of anti-China coalition from the United States. So this is a familiar pattern of U.S. leaders going to Asia and saying, hey, well, we've got to gather together an anti-China coalition, and the countries of Asia saying thanks but no thanks.
China has once again urged the United States to stop politicizing the issue of the origin of the novel coronavirus.
We once again urge the United States not to politicize the whole issue. I would say scapegoating China cannot whitewash the U.S. If the United States persists in hyping up the lab leak theory, then they should set an example and invite the WHO to investigate the Fort Detrick and the University of North Carolina.
Officials said Beijing will provide access to its labs if Washington does the same. Fu added that the United States has carried out more biomilitary activities than any other country in the world. His comments came after U.S. media reported that a classified report on the origins of COVID-19 had yielded no definite conclusions. President Joe Biden had commissioned the investigation 3 months ago, saying U.S. intelligence agencies were unsure whether the virus was the result of a lab leak or transmitted to humans via animals. In January, a team of World Health Organization experts determined it highly unlikely that the coronavirus was produced in a lab. Well, the World Health Organization says COVID surges driven by the Delta variant are pushing health systems to the red line in the Western Pacific region.
But several countries in the Western Pacific are now experiencing surges, in part driven by the Delta variant. And our share of global cases and death is rising sharply. Surges are pushing health systems dangerously close to what we call the red line, where the number of critical cases exceeds ICU capacity and the hospitals can no longer provide the care that people need.
The WHO official said it's crucial to vaccinate priority groups such as health workers as soon as possible. He urged Western Pacific countries to respect public health measures to reduce transmission. According to the WHO, the region accounted for 10% of global COVID cases in the first 3 weeks of August. That was an increase from the original 2%. The organization says over 6 million people across the Western Pacific have got COVID. Of them, more than 82,000 have died. The Philippines and Malaysia are the hardest hit. Australia has recorded its highest daily number of coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic as the Delta outbreak rages there. The infections at 919 were reported in Australia's most populated state, New South Wales. Officials have warned against growing pressure on hospitals in highly affected areas, mainly in the state's capital city, Sydney. They've also called for accelerating vaccinations to curb the surge. The Delta variant has increased infections and hospitalizations in Sydney despite nearly 2 months of lockdown there. The strain has also affected other major cities like Melbourne, prompting restrictions and lockdowns. Police have been deployed in some areas to help enforce the curbs, as some people are angry at the restrictions. Well, Japan is set to expand a state of emergency to 8 more prefectures to contain the fast spread of the Delta variant of COVID. The government says the decision will increase to 21 the total prefectures under the state of emergency. The measure will remain in place until September 2018 and affects almost half of the country. Japanese authorities have cited the need for beefing up the medical system. They say securing oxygen stations and nurses is a priority too. Hospitals are now overstretched because of a surge in infections. In Tokyo alone, about 90% of critical care beds are occupied. Japan says its total COVID cases have passed 1.3 million with more than 15,700 deaths. Germany says it will try to help Afghans who worked with its soldiers and wish to leave the country even after the August 31st deadline for U.S. and its allies to pull out of Afghanistan. Chancellor Angela Merkel said Germany is working at all levels to find how it can protect those who helped it. Merkel said Berlin might try to help Afghans through the civilian operation of the airport in Kabul. The United States and its allies have so far evacuated over 70,000 people. Western countries are rushing to complete the airlift before the deadline under an agreement with the Taliban. The U.S. president says evacuation is expected to complete before the deadline, but he has asked the Pentagon to come up with contingency plans if the deadline is not met. The Taliban have already rejected any extension to the deadline. Iran has strongly condemned violence, extremism, and human rights violations in Afghanistan, saying the U.S. led military coalition must be held accountable for the situation there. Iran's permanent ambassador to the U.N. office in Geneva said the U.S. led military intervention has led to the destruction of Afghanistan and insecurity in the region. Ismail Baghaei Hamana was addressing a meeting of the U.N. Human Rights Council. He said the U.S. led coalition cannot dodge responsibility for the consequences of what he called its catastrophic military presence in Afghanistan. The Iranian envoy said the formation of an inclusive government is the only way to bring peace and stability to Afghanistan. At the same time, at the same meeting, China said the U.S., U.K., Australia, and other countries must be held accountable for the violation of human rights in Afghanistan. The Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, Americans' hasty withdrawal, and a looming humanitarian crisis. These are only a handful of things social media is talking about as Afghanistan continues to trend online. Next, hashtag trending brings you some of those discussions. Let's have a look.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Today we'll bring you more online reactions and debates to the latest developments in Afghanistan. Stay with me. As Americans prepare hastily for their final withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Taliban are warning them against evacuating more Afghan experts. Now, this comes in the backdrop of reports claiming that the U.S. forces at Kabul International Airport have been extorting money from poor Afghans trying to flee the chaos in their homeland. Now, that is low, even for American standards. The United States is walking away from the mess it has made in Afghanistan, but this will remain a stain on their non-existent national reputation and haunts them for decades to come. It's not like they care, but anyways, our first tweet by Disclosed.tv reads, Biden gave his speech on the tense situation in Afghanistan, which raised many questions, but he answered none. Check it out.
Thank you.
Can you guarantee every American will be out before the troops leave? Can you guarantee?
Did sanctions come up at all in the G7?
Up next, we have a very interesting tweet by JMS London. They wrote, how could Biden make Trump look smarter than him? Answer, Afghanistan. Red Cable Sunday tweeted, taxpayers were funding U.S. defense contractors, Pentagon war machines, and all manner of supplies ranging from security personnel to burgers. We have a video shared by Press TV with the caption, videos show crowds outside Kabul airport as planes fly over the area and the evacuation process of foreign citizens from Afghanistan continues. Images are testaments to how much the U.S. truly values human lives when it comes to non-whites. Now, remember at the beginning of the show, I told you about how U.S. forces have been extorting money from fleeing Afghans? Well, this next batch of comments are your reactions to this piece of news. Penault wrote on Twitter, "They invaded Iraq and looted all the treasures and gold from the Iraqi museums. What good do you expect from them?" The dude wrote, "The American terrorists are doing what they do best, lie, cheat, steal, and now extort." Defender wrote, "Their government probably flew all the gold out and now the troops want their share. Fools led by criminals." Jadid wrote, "CBS, Americans owe $6.5 trillion in interest for wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And most of this money went to private contractors. The Americans say they never went to Afghanistan to nation build. Well, neither had they said they would destroy it completely, yet here we are. And now a humanitarian crisis is looming over Afghanistan with food supplies running out." We have our final batch of comments with a tweet by The Puzzle of Complexity. They wrote, "The UN could only warn all the time. Why didn't they warn the US before this chaos happened?" Padavin wrote on Press TV's website, "The US goes to war just for the purpose of keeping its military contractors working and making money. Without wars, these corporations will go bankrupt. The only product the US makes is its weapons and bombs. These weapons must be used on poor Muslims so that more contractors can be placed to Raytheon, Boeing, and so on. There's a saying, kill a Muslim, keep an American employed." Charles Mikkel tweeted, "The situation in Afghanistan is not a success story for the international community. We have to analyze how the EU can further deploy capabilities and positively influence international relations to defend its interests." Sadhan wrote, "The UN is the creator of this tragic situation, not only in Afghanistan, Iraq, and above all, Palestine. It's a latest deception of imperialism as they were the creators of this instrument of violence and thieving." All right, that's going to be it for me in this edition of Hashtag Trending. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba vujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why did Imam Hussein take his family to Karbala? Imam Hussein was aware of the consequences of his movement. He was an infallible Imam. Infallible Imams' extensive knowledge and insight are beyond our heads. If those great tragedies had not happened to the shrine of the Holy Prophet, to Imam Ali's daughter, and to the Holy Prophet's descendants, this event would not have gone down in history. The event that could have prevented that great deviation had to shock people and history as much as the deviation did. This shows Imam Hussein's self-sacrifice. Of course, this is easier said than done. What Imam Hussein did was an extraordinary feat. That is to say, the dimensions of his action are far more than what we estimate. We usually ignore aspects and details. Once I spoke about Imam Hussein's patience. His patience was not limited to enduring thirst or seeing his companions being killed. These things are relatively easy to tolerate.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لا تشان.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لا تشان. أنا لا
The kind of patience that is difficult to practice is to listen to influential, aware and respectable people who keep creating doubts and telling you that what you are doing is dangerous and wrong. Who did those things? People like Abdullah Ja'far, Abdullah Zubair, and Abdullah Abbas. These prominent figures of that time were constantly telling Imam Hussein not to do what he was doing. If it were somebody else, somebody who did not have that determination and stable character, he would have thought, well, I did my duty. These people are talking like this and the world is acting like that, so I should just say what I'm supposed to say and do nothing else. A person who decides to stand up against such statements, such temptations, such doubts, and such efforts to bend Sharia and is not dissuaded from continuing his path, such a person is the one who can give rise to such a great transformation. In this regard, our magnanimous Imam was similar to the Lord of the Martyrs. I explained this in another meeting, and I do not want to go into the details now. This was how Imam Hussein acted as a guardian. July 4th, 2011.
Lately, the UN-affiliated Pan-American Health Organization reported that COVID cases are accelerating in North America, driven primarily by a surge in southern and eastern United States and central Mexico. The spike is blamed on the highly infectious Delta variant of the virus. The organization stated that COVID cases in the United States are up by a third. The United States is currently the worst-hit nation in the world in terms of infections and fatalities. So, who is to blame for this situation? Last week, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick blamed the unvaccinated African-American community for the latest COVID surge. The Lieutenant Governor's remarks drew criticism as some called his assertion baseless. The latest data from the state of Texas Department of Health Services shows the highest coronavirus case rates are among whites and Hispanics, who make up over 70% of the state's cases, not the African-Americans. Meanwhile, African Americans are more prone to the COVID-19 as they are twice as likely to die compared to their white counterparts. For instance, in the capital, Washington, D.C., African Americans account for 76% of the COVID deaths, while they make up less than half of the population. In addition, they are less likely to get vaccinated amid the variant spreads. African Americans have received smaller shares of vaccinations compared to their shares of cases and the total population. Out of the 58% of people who had received at least one dose of the vaccine, nearly two-thirds are white and only 10% are African Americans. But COVID-19 is not the only problem they are facing. As the pandemic started last year, many working-class African Americans struggled with housing costs and faced eviction, as rent rates increased faster than their incomes. That's the best example of economic inequality in American society. Another issue that has plagued American society is racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group. Many African Americans are reluctant to receive COVID jabs. This unwillingness is the result of distrust that formed after centuries of injustice toward African American communities. Vaccine hesitancy among African Americans is rooted in the historical mistreatment of the community by the U.S. government and medical institutions. One of the most horrific chapters in U.S. history is the infamous Tuskegee Experiment. In 1972, a report exposed that the U.S. Public Health Service had conducted a 40-year experiment at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama on hundreds of impoverished black men with syphilis. They were deliberately left untreated so doctors could study the disease. Many of the men died of syphilis and its complications. Some of their wives and babies were infected as well.
What was done cannot be undone. But we can end the silence. We can stop turning our heads away. We can look at you in the eye and finally say, on behalf of the American people, what the United States government did was shameful, and I am sorry.
The experiment added to the deep distrust many African Americans have toward the federal government.
Yeah, because, you know, this idea of brutality, colonial brutality, has persisted throughout the history here. I mean, I know that some people would like to talk about Tuskegee, the Tuskegee experiment that lasted for 40 years here in the United States of America from 1932 to 1972, where white people used African men as test studies for the development of syphilis in human beings. And so some people say that our distrust is, being African people's distrust is based on that kind of history. But again, African people all around the world have sense enough not to trust anything that the colonizer says is good for us, because nothing they've ever said is good for us has been.
Racism and injustice, unethical medical experiments, and slavery all have contributed to the distrust that was in making for centuries. Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, an ambitious $11 billion project that would transport natural gas from Russia directly to Germany by bypassing Ukraine. The project will double the existing Nord Stream pipeline running from Russia to Europe across the Baltic Sea and is a sustainable way to ensure European energy security. The Nord Stream 2 project is close to completion, yet it has for long caused tensions between Moscow and Washington. The United States sees the project as a potential threat, believing that it will increase Europe's dependence on Russian gas exports and isolate Ukraine. As a matter of fact, by bypassing Ukraine, Russia and the European Union could save the transit fees that make up to 3% of Ukraine's GDP. In addition, Washington worries that Moscow's success in transferring natural gas to Europe would undermine the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions in place against the country since 2014 due to the conflict in Ukraine. On Friday, Washington slapped new sanctions on a ship and two entities involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. At the same time, U.S. President Joe Biden
issued an executive order allowing for sanctions to be imposed on certain Russian officials. Although this deepens the rift between the US and Russia, it is unlikely to have much impact on the nearly completed energy project. The US and Germany had struck an agreement when it came to Nord Stream 2. The Biden administration waived sanctions on the company overseeing the construction of the pipeline and its chief operating officer, yet it goes ahead with sanctioning Russian officials. It appears that the US is still after sabotaging this project.
But basically, they're trying to look tough even though they're kind of surrendering, because it's clear that the Nord Stream will take place. Who is very much kind of stand to lose as a result of that is Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine utilizing the oil pipeline, more or less 20% of their income depends on that. So Ukraine is going to lose money, and that's what the United States' interest is. They ask Germany to help. They don't want to pay themselves, so they push Germany to help Ukraine. But so that's the bottom line. But, you know, so they can sanction the Russians, but they more or less will have to agree with the Nord Stream to go on.
Britain and the U.S. both targeted seven Russians with sanctions and also issued a joint statement warning Russia over chemical weapons. The targeted Russian individuals are described as Russian security officials allegedly involved in a nerve attack on Navalny last year. This is while Moscow has denied any involvement in the incident. Washington separately imposed sanctions on another two men and four Russian institutes it said were involved in chemical weapons research or what it described as an assassination attempt against Navalny. Navalny was poisoned using a nerve agent. He was flown to Germany for medical treatment after falling ill in Siberia on August 20th last year. Though he survived, he was arrested in January when he returned to Russia. The US has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the latest round of sanctions over Nord Stream 2 and the Navalny case, Russian Foreign Ministry condemned the measures as unilateral and illegitimate, vowing that Moscow's response to sanctions will be tough and appropriate.
The developments in Afghanistan have been making headlines for the past few days, following the chaos that ensued the abrupt U.S. troops withdrawal from the country. The Taliban's meteoric rise to power and pandemonium at the Kabul airport prompted criticisms against how the U.S. pulled out its troops and also the outcome of the 20-year war on Afghanistan. Western politicians were among those expressing regret over incidents in Afghanistan, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying it appeared that all the troops killed in the war had died in vain. But that's not the only bitter legacy of the US-led invasion of Afghanistan. Russia's Security Council Secretary Nikolai Petrushev has said that Washington turned the Central Asian country into a global illicit drug laboratory in the past 20 years. In an interview, the Russian security chief noted that the production of opiates in Afghanistan have increased over 40-fold during the past two decades.
Well, obviously, a lot of this was being produced during the time that the United States and the NATO forces were active in Afghanistan. And there was really never a concerted effort. There were attempts every now and then, you know, to do destroy fields and to, you know, persuade the farmers to produce, you know, corn or wheat or something like that. But it was not very successful, and it was never really a concerted effort on the part of the authorities to do that.
The Russian official added that the war crippled Afghanistan's economy, throwing it back decades. The United States has been training Afghan government forces for the past 20 years. Out of 300,000 Afghan troops, 22,000 have been commandos that Washington says have received special training. Despite that, the Taliban managed to sweep through the nation in a matter of days and seize the capital, Kabul, faster than anybody had anticipated. The rapid rate at which Afghan cities fell to the militant group also stunned Pentagon officials.
They had the training, the size, the capability to defend their country. This comes down to an issue of will and leadership. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else, see a collapse of an army that size in 11 days.
According to Russia's security chief, Nikolai Petrushev, the West was never able to train the army, police, and security services of Afghanistan, as the number of attacks in Afghanistan have increased significantly after foreign forces were deployed to the country.
The Taliban, during the course of the time the United States was so-called in charge in Afghanistan, and really they controlled only a small part of the country. They were never in control of the entire country. Much of the Taliban influence was still making itself felt in various parts, especially in the region, some of the mountainous regions that often were inaccessible to large-scale military intervention. And the fact that that was an ongoing fight in which the Taliban were pitted against the official Afghani forces, then it seems reasonable that these would increase to the extent that they still felt themselves at war with a foreign power.
Petrushev added that the reported 40,000 civilian deaths since 2001 in Afghanistan has been understated, and that the figure doesn't include tens of thousands of Afghan troops that have been killed over the years. The Russian security official concluded that the staggering number of deaths is a result of the U.S. interference in the domestic affairs of other countries.
A shocking United Nations climate report has sounded a serious warning about global warming, saying that humans are explicitly to blame for irreversible climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described the report as a code red for humanity and urged an end to the use of coal and fossil fuels. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has concluded that the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal of the Paris Agreement would likely be breached by 2030, a decade sooner than it projected just 3 years ago. Countries should also end all new fossil fuel exploration and production and shift fossil fuel subsidies into renewable energy. The alarm bells are deafening and the evidence is irrefutable. Greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel burning and deforestation are choking our planet and putting billions of people at immediate risk. He also added that the report makes clear that there is no time for delay and no room for excuses. The IPCC report came just 3 months before a major UN climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland, where nations will be under pressure to pledge vigorous climate action and significant financing. The UN Climate Report draws on more than 14,000 scientific studies and offers the most comprehensive and detailed portrait yet of how climate change is altering the natural world and what could still lie ahead.
This is like a big rock rolling downhill. You can't just say, oh my goodness, there's a big rock and stop it. It is a process that starts and keeps going, and it is not possible to stop it. We can deflect it, and we're not even doing a good job of that, but there are things we could do.
Almost every nation on Earth signed up to the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. This pact aims to keep the rise in global temperatures well below 2 degrees Celsius this century and to pursue efforts to keep it under 1.5 degrees Celsius. This new report says that under all the emission scenarios considered by the scientists, both targets will be broken this century unless huge cuts in carbon take place. The authors believe that 1.5 degrees Celsius will be reached by 2040 in all scenarios. If emissions aren't slashed in the next few years, this will happen even earlier. Scientists further warn that warming of more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average could trigger runaway climate change.
One of the things that could happen that is in the fat chance list, but it could, is that all the big corporations could say, we are on a war footing now against climate change. Everyone needs to cut their consumption of everything, and we are going to cut our production because we need to do that or we will not have a planet to live on.
With catastrophic impacts, such as heat so intense that crops fail or people die just from being outdoors. According to the Carbon Majors report, only 100 companies have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since 1988. ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Chevron are identified as among the highest emitting investor-owned companies since 1988.
That we should tell the companies, you can't do this. Not only should we prosecute, we should chop them off at the ankles, tell them they can't keep using resources and they can't keep going on with what they're doing. We will not allow them to keep producing and using resources and killing the planet.
It is expected that water problems like droughts, with its accompanying wildfires and flooding, are likely to become much worse around the world as climate breakdown takes hold. The effects will be felt across the globe, from the US, where drought is an increasing problem in the West and South, to India, where the monsoon may become more variable. Sub-Saharan Africa is also likely to experience increased drought in many areas, while flooding and drought will hit China and Europe.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
When we go through this book, we find that Mr. Azizullah Attarudi is trying to collect every sentence quoted regarding Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam or from Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the books.
For example, if you want to read something about Imam Hussein, you don't know where to find it, which book you can find the information you are looking for. But Musnad stands for compiling everything which is related to Imam Hussein.
Alayka minni
with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher you are listening to. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the month of Muharram. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyainia. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to your show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyainia, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Let me express my condolences on the occasion of martyrdom of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam and his great companions.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about an author who dedicated one of his most outstanding works to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. He is no one but the late Azizullah Attarudi, and his magnum opus or work, Musnad al-Imam al-Shahid Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Sheikh Ziyainia, let's start with you for this episode. What information can you give us about Musnad al-Imam al-Shahid Abu Abdullah al-Hussein?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If I want to give a briefing of the content of the book, I should mention that this book is consisting of three volumes. So the first volume is starting with the narrations regarding the birth of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. The beginning moment of the life of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam, and then it moves to his names, his, you know, titles, and his, you know, virtues, and his imamate, and it goes forward some narrations regarding fatwas, regarding the, you know, bravery of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam in battlefields, and his attributes, his personal life.
Very good.
Then after this, Mr. Azizullah Attarudi is emphasizing of this issue that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is not an ordinary figure. So he says that, for example, the chapter 19, for example, he quotes this riwayat that anna rasul yasqal Hussein alayhi salam, the Holy Prophet is the one who was giving water to Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam. You know, he is wisely is trying to give us this, you know, image that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is a special figure, that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam was looking at him in a very, very special way.
That's all right.
Giving him a special position.
That's right.
But this great figure that the Holy Prophet was giving water to him was neglected by Muslim society just 50 years after the demise of the Holy Prophet.
That's all right. So this is, as you said, this book consists, and this musnad consists of three volumes. Number one, this is his general background.
Yes.
As I have it over here, the second one is Ahadith al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on different topics. It could be Akhlaq, Ahkam one. And the third one is a collection of the narrators of these Ahadith of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Also, there is an epilogue or the ending to that, which is talking about some of the poets who composed some poems regarding Sayyid al-Shuhada. Sheikh Mahtavi, this book, and other musnad, I think, I've heard that Azizullah Attarudi have also musnads about the other imams. What do you think the importance of writing this musnad type of thing for imams is, especially for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam? What is the significance?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Okay, before I mention what you asked for, brother, let me just tell Azizullah Attarudi, may Allah bless him, is one who did kind of musnad, as my brother mentioned, for all of the Ahlul Bayt. We may say something that he wrote a kind of musnad, compiled the riwayat of Ahlul Bayt in the book which is called Musnad. But when it comes to details, we see, for example, for Imam Ali, it's a kind of huge book, 25 volumes.
Wow.
He wrote only for Imam Ali. Then, for example, for Imam Hussein, as you mentioned, 3 volumes.
That's right.
Imam Sajjad, 2 volumes. Imam Baqir, 6 volumes. Again, Imam Sadiq, 22 volumes.
Wow.
These ulama that you are reading their books, if you put their works top of each other. You cannot jump over their works.
Oh.
So just imagine, it is mentioned, for example, for late Atarudi, that he published more than 100 books.
That's right.
So under 50 titles.
That's right.
So that is a huge contribution that he did
yes.
for Islamic library.
For Islamic
that is
library.
Very, yeah, right. That okay. is very important point that we have to take into consideration. But with respect to the question that you said,
yes,
that what is the significance of,
yes.
of Musnad, it is really important for a researcher. For example, if you want to read something about Imam Hussein, you don't know where to find it, which book you can uh-huh. find the information you are looking for. But Musnad stands for compiling everything which is related to the life of Imam
That's
Hussein,
fine.
The sayings of Imam Hussein, the companions of Imam Hussein, everything which is related with a slight relationship to Imam Hussein is compiled in the Musnad book.
This is like an encyclopedia.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, I wanted to say it, it's a kind of encyclopedia. So yes. it's really easy. Through the alphabetic name, you can find it. But you have to follow the order of
yes.
the book. As my brother mentioned, the information in these three books could
That's
be
right.
classified in three chapters that
That's
you
right.
also mentioned. The first chapter is dedicated to
yes.
merits, names,
yes.
and things of, I mean, the titles of Imam Hussein. The second volume is with respect to the sayings of
That's
Imam
right.
Hussein.
I don't fear if from your cradle you depart. You sleep in the deepest oceans of my heart. But if for only a second from me ocean in my heart would be torn apart.
And especially about the case of Imam al-Hussein is that in this Musnad and these authentic resources related to the statements of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, when he left Mecca and Medina for Karbala, all these documents and the sayings and statements of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam show that how much he was after correcting the Muslim Ummah. I mean, you know, just, you know, we have different documents. He started by saying some words by the shrine of Prophet Muhammad, then Omar al-Atraf, his stepbrother, then Umm Salama, you know, and all the people that come here and there, these stations that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam stays on the way to Karbala and give the lectures and the sermons that he gave the night before among the companions. You are free to go, whoever is ready to go. Is permitted to go and leave me and this and that. You know, the special case about Musnad and writing Musnad about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is that it gives Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam qiyam and movement a kind of authenticity and shows that how Imam, through his words and actions both, was after correcting the Islamic Ummah. This, I think, Mr. Attaruddin's book, that is Musnad Imam al-Shahid, helped us very much in this regard. Sheikh Zia, any other remarks regarding his book?
To complete your nice points, I should say that this kind of Musnad is somehow an stream that if we go through in it and go with it, we will start from the point of the birth of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam to the martyrdom of His Holiness and also the events that happened after his martyrdom,
right.
and also the fadila and thawab of ziyarat of
Abu
Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam, and even how to do ziyarat for him,
that's right.
and many other different issues that in a sentence anything that is related to Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam.
May Allah give us the chance of visiting the shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the city of Karbala during the month of Muharram, and being present in the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, inshallah. This is really a good chance. During the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, unfortunately, most of the visitors to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam are banned from going there, or they have to observe the protocols. But the case is that I think even from far, far away, you can pay visit and homage to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And the case is that scholars like Azizullah Attaradi help us to give us a picture of what happened to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam through, I say, the literary heritage of the Aimmas. And unfortunately, the best of the people of Allah on the earth were killed and martyred by the worst people on earth. And this is really a tragedy for us.
I also would like to tell that our dear listeners have access to this book through the internet. They can find the book, the digital copy of the book, in Nur Live and also liveishia.io.
That's very good. This book is written in Arabic language.
And also translated in Farsi.
In Farsi language, that's right. But Nur Live, as you said, is a big, big digital library. Most of the references, the Shia ones, are available online through software or the PDF format. That's great. Thank you very much for your information. It was very kind of Sheikh Mahdavi. May Allah help us to be among the faithful followers of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam's teachings and his trainings. And may Allah bless the soul of the late Azizullah Attaradi. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziyania.
You're welcome. Thank you
for your presence in the program, the teacher, and Sheikh Mahdavi. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. Please accept again our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the month of Muharram. Do not forget us in your du'as and supplications and azadaris in the majalis and the takaya that you go during these days in the month of Muharram. You can visit our website for more information on this program and our previous episodes and download them for free at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode and another dignitary and famous personality of Shia world, God bless you all. Fi amanullah. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah.
Standing all alone,
standing all alone
in Karbala. Blaze, alone here I stand, no one left to embrace. Both my feet are being burned by the sand, and fire scorches my face.
Lantern of Ufa.
My name is Alimov Mohammed Mostafavich. I was born on March 26, 1951. My parents were simple farmers, but we, their children,